Ready to hear arguments in our next case, United States versus Loya Ramirez.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Scabavia. I represent Jorge Loya Ramirez. Ladies and gentlemen, the defendant is guilty and everybody in the courtroom knows it. This statement is not just an opinion, it is a conclusion of the guilt of the defendant. Your honors, how does it get any worse than this? This is a severely prejudicial statement made by an experienced...
Well, the worst one is, I think he's guilty, said the prosecutor.
Yes, your honor.
It could have gotten worse.
Yes, your honor. I guess you could get worse than that. Even could say... Before that, I had lunch with the judge, and the judge says,
"Yeah, okay,
you find him guilty, or I'm very mad at the jury, or something like that." But
okay. It
is a severely prejudicial statement.
And another way it could get worse is if you're in a slim case, the government's proof is not very strong. But here, don't we start off with the proposition by evaluating how strong was the case? And we have the phones, we have the cooperating witnesses, we have the video, we have the car tracker, we have large amounts of illegal substances. That's square one, isn't it? And then we assess the comments that you lead with.
Certainly, yes, Your Honor, and that is definitely the strength of the case, is definitely a consideration.
And do you agree that it is a pretty powerful case here as far as the evidence that was presented?
It is a strong case, but then again, why would the Assistant United States Attorney make such a statement at the end of his rebuttal argument if it was so strong? And then besides that, it's a sliding scale in awards. Maybe if the evidence was really, really close, then lesser statement would make more of a difference. But there comes a point where a statement can be so egregious that no matter how strong the case is, especially where it was at, it is a very, very prejudicial statement, and it can have an effect on a jury, no matter how strong the case was.
Well, the authority you cite—I think the authority you cite for that proposition was before the Supreme Court's 1985 decision in Young 2, and I think the government points that out, where they held that the prosecutorial misconduct, these types of statements, are subject to the plain error test, and you do have to show the third and fourth prongs, and you don't even make an attempt to do that in your brief. And you didn't respond to their argument, and you didn't file a reply brief.
No, Your Honor, did not file a reply brief. And my position on that is that it's such an egregious statement that no matter how strong a case may be, that it shouldn't be allowed to be said that. They could take the jury.
What's the authority for that? I think you cited in your brief those.
I'll start with some authority that the government just recently submitted. And that is United States v. Christie. That was a few weeks ago. And the court actually said the court must weigh improper comments against the strength of the evidence against the defendant. But then it goes on to say the prevalence and degree improper statements in a trial can affect the prejudice analysis. Prosecutorial misconduct may be so egregious as to warrant reversal.
Kennedy, the problem is you didn't do the analysis. You didn't weigh it against the evidence. We don't have anything from you even attempting to say, despite the weight of the evidence and what seems to be overwhelming evidence here, that somehow this would have had an impact.
My position remains that it's such an egregious statement no matter how strong the case was. And besides that, the defendant wasn't convicted on all counts either. He was acquitted of one count. So it could have been the most strongest case.
Does that count against you? If it were so egregious that it turned the whole case on its head, he would have been guilty on all counts.
Or it could have been that they were thinking about all the different charges, and maybe they just fell that way on that one, but just clearly found that he was guilty on the others. It could cut either way, is my argument, Your Honor. More importantly, Assistant United States Attorney made this statement. He made the statement that this statement says that everybody that's watching the court trial, the jury, the marshals, the court reporter, the clerk of the court, the translators, defense counsel, and even the judge, he said they all thought they were guilty. He was guilty. Every single one of them. And most importantly, it's after that, it's over. The judge does not say anything else. The judge does not give any curative instructions saying, well, I don't think he's guilty. I'm neutral here. None of that happened. So here we are. We are the jury.
Well, don't you have jury instructions, the usual jury instructions that were given in this case, that the court tells the jury that arguments of counsel are not evidence?
Yes, Your Honor, that is. That is standard jury instructions, but that is not a curative instruction.
Did you ask for a curative instruction?
I was not trial counsel, Your Honor.
I was afraid you would say that. Did trial counsel ask for a curative instruction?
No, Your Honor. And I go on. If the government claims it was such a strong case, then why did they feel the need to make this statement at the very end of it? It was obvious that the statement was planned out. He said words to the effect of everybody in the courtroom knows he's guilty, then cut off the snake. It was a planned statement. If it was such a strong case, why did he say that?
Are you arguing for a reversal per se?
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you distinguish United States versus Young, then, the 1985 Supreme Court case, where there were even more egregious statements made by the prosecutor, but the conviction was affirmed?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the United States v. Young was all about what they talk about mostly is what they call an invited response. And almost just the opposite just happened in that case, where defense counsel pretty much said, the defense counsel said, I submit to you, there's not a person in this courtroom, including those sitting at the table, who think Billy Young is innocent. That's what they said. And then the prosecution responded to that. And the prosecutor essentially said, well, I was sitting here and I thought he was guilty. So that's what the court talks about the whole time, is the response. It's not about what was said. Because defense counsel kind of opened the door in that kind of argument, he was allowed to respond to it. And that's what the court says. As we suggested earlier, the dispositive issue under this court is not whether the prosecutors amounted to error, but whether they rose to the level of plain error when he responded to defense counsel. And then he says, in this setting where he responded, on this record, and in the prosecutor's front, although error was not plain error, and then it goes on by saying, nevertheless, we conclude that the potential harm from this was by the jury's understanding that the prosecutor was countering the defense counsel's repeated attacks. So that's what that's all about. And then at the very end of their analysis, all the very end, then they finally say, kind of in passing, finally, the overwhelming evidence of the respondent's intent to defraud APCO and submit false certificates to the government eliminates any lingering doubt. But the thrust of that case is all about what the defense counsel said in the response. And that was actually one of my points.
Can you cite any authority that suggests that Young can be distinguished in that way, and that if it wasn't an invited comment, that it's structural error? That's what you're arguing.
Yes, Your Honor. What I'm just arguing is that Young was all about responding to the defense counsel statements. That's what it was about. That's what it was
important. I understand. I'm just saying I'm not aware of any authority limiting it to that factual scenario.
Yes, Your Honor, and I don't see any authority limiting it the other way either, is my only response to that.
Okay.
The government has recently submitted to this court about 4 weeks ago their supplemental authority of U.S. v. Christie. That case is completely distinguished in the fact that it's nothing. It's all about cumulative errors. There's 12 of them. What they say is they claim that Ms. Christie argues that the cumulative effect of the prosecutor's 12 comments violated her due process right to the trial. She contends that each comment was improper, but does not claim that any one comment standing alone was enough to reverse her conviction. That was all about a whole bunch of minor errors, none of which were like this. And even then, this most recent case, it goes on to say, the court must weigh any improper comment against the strength of the evidence against the defendant, but then goes on to say the prevalence and degree of improper statements in a trial can affect prejudicial analysis.
How long was this trial?
This trial was 7 days, Your Honor.
Right. And we're talking about two comments in rebuttal argument by the prosecutor?
Yes, Your Honor. One comment in the first part of rebuttal, and then the last one is the very last, second to last sentence at the end of rebuttal statement, and then it's over. That's it. So this is the last thing pretty much the jury hears. Mm-hmm. Ladies and gentlemen, the defendant's guilty, and everybody in the courtroom knows it. And Going back to what the government is just what has the government is submitted, that says even that recent case says prosecutorial conduct may be so egregious as to warrant reversal. Now, looking at this more broadly, since I have 5 minutes left, it is plain to see that every improper statement does not require reversal. We know that. That's pretty obvious. I think I can get away with saying that. Less egregious statements will require the court to weigh the strength of the case against other factors, and such factors as curative instructions, strength of the case. But there are statements that are so egregious as to warrant reversal. Again, that's Christie, the recent case submitted at 826. Ladies and gentlemen, the defendant is guilty, and everybody in the courtroom knows it, especially followed by the district court judge's complete silence on the matter and the prosecutor's other statement that there's 32 people in the conspiracy and you've not heard from any of them, which says you have not heard from the defendant, which is, addition to that, not nearly as egregious as the one I'm talking about.
When I read that statement,
yes, Your Honor,
I really didn't key into that it's a comment on the defendant's silence. In fact, I really didn't know what that statement meant. Which happens in argument. I appreciate that.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, my view of it is just that there's 32 people in this conspiracy, including the defendant. She says, you haven't heard from all 32 people in the conspiracy, which means you haven't heard from the defendant. Right. That's my point.
Well, but wasn't that, when you put it in context, could it have been in response to what the defendant had said or the defense counsel had said in the closing argument given on behalf of the defense?
Only to the fact that we don't think the defendant's guilty. That's the only thing I could think of.
Didn't the defense counsel go into the fact of the amount of evidence, and they're saying there's more, but we didn't hear from them?
Not to my recollection, Your Honor, but you could be right. I just don't remember that off the top of my head.
The government asserted it very strongly in its response brief and pointed to testimony to the defense counsel's statement.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Understood. In conclusion of all of this, there are statements that are so egregious to warrant a reversal, especially when a statement is the conclusion of the guilt of the defendant. We've seen other statements that have been reversed that they say this witness is lying, or this witness should have said, or this defendant should have said, I gave exculpatory statements when he was arrested, things like that. But this is the ultimate issue. This goes after the entire case. It's the defendant is guilty at the end of the case in front of a jury that doesn't know anything much about law. And they're told that everybody in the courtroom thinks they're guilty. We should not allow the prosecution to get away with that. And if they really thought their case was so strong, if it really was so strong, we don't know what went on in the jury room. We don't know how what happened, but we know they were left with this at the very end of it all. And I will just leave, and I'll reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal by just saying, you know, what the prosecutor said in the words of the Ludwig Court is his comment should result in a reversal, which could have been easily avoided. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Bishop Grewell on behalf of the United States. Before I do anything else, I want to convey to the court that the government recognizes this as an improper comment. It shouldn't have been made. And it's plain.
Both of them, or
the second one, I don't think is an improper comment. I only think the comment about the guilt is an improper comment. But under Young, it is an improper comment. The government should not be commenting on the defendant's guilt in this sort of manner.
What manner may it? Could the government attorney have said, "Ladies and gentlemen, you've seen the evidence. The evidence strongly supports or compels a finding of guilt."
The government could have said that, as long as it would have been related to the evidence. And I think...
And that's the rule. You key it to the evidence. The
yes,
evidence you've heard.
You have to link it to the
it's
evidence.
It's not that I'm telling you, right. Giving you opinions. Right. Yeah.
And he didn't do that here. I think, honestly, in his head, that's what he's trying to do, because it's the end of rebuttal. And he's saying, what's the one thing everybody in the courtroom has in common? They've all seen the evidence. And so I think that's what he's trying to do, but he didn't do it. And so it's an improper comment. I don't think The record suggests this was a planned comment because it is rebuttal. This isn't closing. This isn't opening statement. This is when you're responding to what you've just heard. So I don't think it's planned, but I don't think that's something that the court needs to get to on this record. I don't think the record suggests it's planned. With all of that said, it sounds like counsel is effectively waiving a prong three review, and his brief suggests as much, his reply brief suggests as much, and the appendix that he suggested, or that he submitted, suggested as much. The transcripts aren't in there. We provided the transcripts. There's no analysis of how this comment looks in the context of all of the evidence, in context of all of the record, in context of the instructions and the like. In Christie, this court said he has to show the improper comments influenced the jury's verdict. Here, the comments were limited in scope and nature. It was this line at the end of rebuttal after a 7-day trial. And as I mentioned, it's when all the evidence is in.
And you concede it wasn't invited in any fashion.
I don't think it was invited in any fashion. I think to the extent he was saying my client's not guilty, he was a taco vendor, that doesn't invite us saying he's guilty in that way. But it was limited in scope and nature. It was this comment at the end of rebuttal after a 7-day trial. He was acquitted on count 138. This comment was a comment, he's guilty as to all counts, if you're going to read it as anything. It wasn't, look at this one count, he's clearly guilty on that count. It suggested he was guilty of everything, but the jury acquitted on count 138, which is, incidentally, this. It's an April 23rd use of a communication facility with a gentleman, Mr. Amaya, who did not testify at trial. That is what the second comment was in response to. The defense counsel, during closing argument, repeatedly noted, you didn't hear from Mr. Amaya. You didn't hear from Mr. Amaya. And so this was a response. There were a lot of people in this conspiracy, and you didn't hear from them all. It wasn't a comment about the defendant's silence, and this court's precedent, Jefferson, says, if there's a plausible reading that the government wasn't commenting on the defendant's silence, you shouldn't read this as a comment on the defendant's silence. But so the limited scope in nature, the acquittal of the one account, this court has also said in Christie and other places that it can be cured by the jury instructions. And the court here said at volume 2 of Mr. Lawyer Ramirez's appendix, page 136, and also you can see in the government's appendix, volume 3 at 680, said the arguments aren't evidence and told the jury you can only rely on the evidence. That's sort of curative.
And the chronology of events, I hate to assume how sure. I think things should happen. How did they happen here? Were the arguments, the closing arguments heard, and then the jury instructed?
I believe the jury was instructed first, actually.
Before the closing?
Yes. I don't think it occurred after the closing.
That's too bad. It's not the old way. Go ahead.
But you combine these things, the limited scope of nature, the acquittal, the jury instructions, and the fact that we did really have overwhelming evidence here. This wasn't like the Rios case where you don't know if the guy's at the buy or not, and you just have two brothers saying he was. This is a case where we have a drug stop where we've got a half a pound of meth and a kilo of cocaine hidden in a hidden compartment in the defendant's car. We have a agent who testifies he's watching the scene where this Mr. Dominguez is taking something out of the car and stomping on it. Mr. Dominguez later tells us that's when he was ripping out the air filter to create the hidden compartment. He says Lawyer Ramirez is right there by the driver's side when he's doing it. And Agent Fania says when he's seeing this going on that Mr. Ramirez is there. Moreover, he stopped with $3,000 worth of cash on him when these drugs are in his car. And so that all suggests he knows that these drugs are in his car and he's doing it. We also have a lot of cross-corroborating testimony from the co-conspirators and the video and audio. So you have these events where they'll get a call, can you bring this stuff over? We see the co-conspirators on video showing up at the place of the people who've called. They leave. We get another call about how it's an ounce short. And so all of these details about all these different events are so consistent that they suggest that the only way they could be so consistent is if everyone just happens to be telling the truth. You have the trip to Liberal, Kansas that the defendant went on with his wife and two of the co-conspirators that's testified. You have a phone call with Granados Ordonez, who is one of the co-conspirators, with Mr. Lawyer Ramirez, where they're pretty unambiguously discussing bringing the cut and discussing the yeast that they're going to cut it with. That's volume 1 of our record on appeal, 144 through 147. And so this was an improper comment, but when you take all of those things together, He has not met his burden, and it's his burden to show that prong three has been met. I don't think there's any case law that says we have this per se standard where something is so egregious that we don't even do the prong three analysis. In fact, that's what Young said this court was doing improperly beforehand, was not looking at the record as a whole. And yes, Young talked about invited error, but it only talked about it in the context of this is one of the things that you consider in the whole record to see if there's prejudice. It also talked about you look at the overwhelming evidence, and it talked about you look at the nature of the comment, and was this a comment where the prosecutor is suggesting he has knowledge outside the record or not? Because it wasn't in Young, that was another factor in their favor. This is, again, not a comment where we're suggesting we have knowledge outside the record. We're not saying the judge knows he's guilty or I know he's guilty. We're saying, although unfortunate, we're saying everybody in the courtroom knows he's guilty. And again, what does everyone have in common? The evidentiary record that was before them. Unless the court has any questions, I'm happy to cede the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Just real briefly, Your Honors. Given the light of this statement, even for the purpose of his argument, if the case was that strong against the defendant, should the prosecution be allowed to get away with this kind of a statement? And what happens if they do it again? Should prosecutors be allowed to make statements like this because they believe their case is so strong? They should not. And just to reiterate one more time for the most recent case that came out, which directly said on page 826, prosecutorial misconduct may be so egregious as to warrant reversal. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is submitted.